We are joined once again by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of the past week's news. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Habits are hard to break.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By the way, I really like that music.
It's going to take a year to...
That's a great replacement for our longtime theme.
You think so?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You're just being sarcastic.
No, I like it.
Okay.
I like it. I'm never sarcastic. Come on.
Yeah.
that brief exercise in sarcasm was brought to you by...
Job has been replaced.
Getting a well-earned laugh.
All right, let's a ton to cover in just a short hour.
Yeah, we need those laughs after this week.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, wild ride. Okay, but starting out with local and, it's election season is upon us, I guess.
Yeah, we are now officially into the city council campaigns. 7 district seats are up for election this coming summer and fall. The primary is in August. And 2 incumbents this week announced that they were, in fact, planning to run for re-election. Shama Sawant launched her re-election campaign at Sabah Ethiopian Restaurant, which is about to be displaced. So another gleaming, hideous new high-rise can take its place. That's at 12th and Yesler. And is planning to run her re-election not against a specific opponent, but against Amazon, saying basically, who do you want to run Seattle? So that's going to be her theme. And I'll talk a little bit more about her later on and her her committee held this week. Also, in Northeast Seattle, Deborah Juarez announced that she was going to run for re-election, an announcement that was greeted by, I'm not going to try and characterize the emotions by many people who have been seen her performance in her first term kind of with dismay. She has very much been on the side of business interests on council and is the only person among the 4 who originally opposed the head tax last year, who is running for re-election. So we'll see who runs against her and what kind of traction those respective candidates get. A number of candidates have already announced for each of the 7 seats, so it's going to be a pretty competitive primary, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the incumbents do and how the open seat races go. We have 3 council members who are retiring, those being the 3 proponents of the head tax last year, Sally Bagshaw, Bruce Harrell, and Rob Johnson, are all retiring. You can see how much of an impact Rob Johnson made. I can't even remember his name. We'll be talking a lot more about that as the year goes by, I'm sure.
Yeah, Deborah Juarez, just a reminder to folks, represents District 5 in North Seattle. She's been a supporter of the business lobby, as Jav mentioned. She's chaired the Civic Development Public Assets and Native Communities Committee, where she's overseen the waterfront development project, which has been smooth sailing through the council so far. This week, her committee passed a 3-part package of legislation to push forward that project, including a bill to create a waterfront local improvement district, another bill to set up a maintenance agreement for the new waterfront park, and then a 3rd bill to address the concerns of property owners inside the local improvement district, or LID, basically to lower their taxes and use the scarce city transportation funding to cover the gap. And that's right in line with previous city projects that have used transportation dollars to fund real estate development. I'm thinking in particular of the Mercer Beautification Project, the South Lake Union Trolley, and the First Hill Streetcar.
And that is what the waterfront project is all about. It's all about real estate.
Yeah, and even Danny Westneat, the columnist at the Seattle Times, the conservative Seattle Times, agreed this week that streetcars are not transit projects, that they don't benefit people who are trying to get around town. They really benefit property owners along the transit lines, and that they really serve the function of real estate development projects, not of transportation goals. And Deborah Juarez has been right along with that crew. Now, Shama Sawant, she represents District 3, which is Capitol Hill in the Central District. Sawant chairs the Human Services, Equitable Development, and Renters' Rights Committee, and she's the vice chair of the Civil Rights, Utilities, Economic Development, and Arts Committee. Excuse me. She has said that she will not participate in the Democracy Voucher Program during her reelection because it places limits on the overall campaign spending that a district candidate can do to a total of $150,000 for both the primary and the general together. Also, individuals can only donate $250 at a maximum. Sawant's anticipating needing a lot more than that to overcome any pro-business challenger that's in that district race.
However, if she has a challenger that spends a lot of money or benefits from a PAC that spends a lot of money in that race, those caps lift.
Yeah.
So, you know, other than the individual limits, of course, are still a constraint.
Yeah.
And Sawant has a formidable capacity to fundraise. She has a lot of grassroots supporters, and she actually out-fundraised her business opponent 4 years ago, Pamela Banks, and raised nearly $500,000 in her race. So she has a large fundraising base and doesn't want to be constrained by that. And really, the Democracy Voucher Program, when it was conceived, didn't really anticipate the model that's been emerging, and we saw with Bernie Sanders in 2016, and we've seen with some other grassroots candidates, of people who managed to raise a lot of money through small grassroots donations. The interesting thing about Sawant versus Banks in 2015 is that Sawant outraised Banks, even though Banks' average donation was about five times that of Sawant. Sawant's donations tended to be very small, but she got lots and lots of them. So this is the first district race in which Democracy Vouchers have been used, and Sawant decided to opt out of it because of those constraints.
Yeah, and you know, she gets a lot of criticism from folks in the business community and some of her constituents who are more conservative leaning for not representing her district. For example, they like to cite the Showbox Theater, which is not in her district, it's downtown. But you know, it's very much a concern of one of the committees that she's on, the Economic Development and Arts Committee in particular.
And Sally Bagshaw was totally missing in action in that.
Yeah, vibrant.
That's her district.
Yeah, and you know, a vibrant arts community makes a vibrant city. And Capitol Hill has been sort of the cultural center of Seattle for a long time with a very vibrant community of musicians and artists who live and perform there. So it very definitely was within her purview to take on the Showbox fight. In addition, her current fight to protect one of the last mobile home parks in Seattle, which is located near Northgate, falls very squarely within her Human Services Equitable Development and Renters Rights Committee. It's a community mostly of elderly folks who are renters, and they're facing possible displacement and redevelopment of the property by U.S. Bank, which is managing that property for an estate trust.
And that's Juarez's district, and she's been missing in action on that.
And she's not done a thing on that. So it makes complete sense that Shama Sawant would step forward and take those on. And she is right to say that those issues are issues that impact people within her district. But more importantly, it impacts the work of the two main committees, of which she is chair and vice chair. And that's something that we haven't seen a lot of other council members really take on and talk about, is balancing the needs of their district with the committee assignments that they have. And Sawant has done that very well. So when people attack her, they're really attacking her for work that she is assigned to do and should be doing as a city council member and chair and vice chair of those important committees.
And one of the things that came out in her reelection announcement, she had a succession of about a dozen speakers who, you know, gave testimony to various struggles that they've been involved in and her office having helped out with them. They were almost all people of color. There were a lot of immigrants. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of LGBTQ people represented. And she talked in her comments about, you know, Capitol Hill having lost its cultural identity of LGBTQ with all the new people that have moved in, and that having been taken away and wanting to restore that. That's very much a District 3 concern. But what you heard, you know, people talking about her having assisted them, a lot of them were from District 3, of course, but some of them weren't. But the ones that weren't talked about how they went to other council members and nobody else would give them the time of day. And she was the one who was willing to listen to people who hadn't written a check to other council members and who aren't traditionally heard in Seattle politics. And that really is the function role she's been playing on council for the last 6 years, like five years.
Having an open door to everyday people, whereas a lot of the city council members in the past and some current city council members have an open door to business lobbyists. Yeah. And she has not had that. She's had an open door to people who are not business lobbyists. She's also been one of the city council members who doesn't actively schmooze with the mainstream media, like, for example, Lorena Gonzalez or Sally Bagshaw. She tends to be very careful about who she gives interviews to and who she will sit down and talk with in the media.
She's been burned a little bit in the past.
Yeah, and so the mainstream media tends to really play up the statements of her critics rather than to talk directly to her or even look into what she's actually been doing on the council.
Yeah, and you know, from day one, she's been very consistent in, you know, trying to give a voice to the voiceless, et cetera, on council, and really has the clearest identity of any council member in memory. And that identity is something that the business community really feels threatened by and is targeted, even though she's only one of nine council members.
Yeah, the fact that there was a recent storm in the local media about Sawant being controlled by Socialist Alternative Party, of which she's a member, which really I looked at that and I just kind of laughed because, you know, we don't talk about how Democrats have a loyalty to the Democratic Party and how Republicans have a loyalty to the Republican Party. We can certainly see the clearest example of that at the national level, where the Republican Party is lined up to support a president who's obviously off his rocker.
And who many of whose positions are diametrically opposed to traditional Republican orthodoxy.
Yeah. And yet when it comes to a woman who is openly avowed that she's a socialist and who is a member and who's always said that she's a member of the Socialist Alternative Party, you know, there's all of a sudden this concern among the local press and people who just sort of absorb the business line without really thinking about it or criticizing it, that she's some kind of Socialist Party zombie.
Yeah, and that really is a red baiting kind of tactic.
It is.
All right. Moving on, a update on police reform.
Yeah. Last week, the Seattle Times, not this past week, but the week before, the Seattle Times published a story saying that they had gotten hold of emails on how the arbitration settlement was finalized in the Adley Shepard case. Officer Adley Shepard is the police officer who punched a woman who was handcuffed in the back of his police car. He was fired in 2016 by former police chief Kathleen O'Toole, and then he, with the help of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, his union, was able to select an arbitrator and go through a closed door arbitration process that ruled that he should be reinstated with back pay. Now, the article in the Times said that arbitration ruling was finalized on October 31st of last year, 3 weeks before the city council voted on whether or not to approve the Seattle Police Officers Guild new contract that would have rolled back police reforms related to police discipline and would have allowed the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the Seattle Police Department to retain the closed-door arbitration process, which had been eliminated through a city council approved law that would have instituted broad police reform practices in the city of Seattle. Now, the council voted to approve that contract in November, raising the issue of, was Adley Shepard's arbitration agreement delayed in order to allow the city council to approve the contract first and not have to deal with a controversy over how Shepard was first fired and then reinstated through the closed-door arbitration process?
I can answer that question.
Yeah. And it's worth remembering, too, that among those emails was a comment by a Seattle Police Officers Guild representative who termed the delay possibly unethical. And that the emails seemed to indicate that the delay was because of the political process of the SPOG contract. Now, City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez this week, she chairs the Gender Equity Safe Communities New Americans and Education Committee. That's the committee responsible for public safety. She said this week that she wants more information about why the arbitration ruling was delayed. Also, the Community Police Commission issued a statement saying that the evidence presented by the Seattle Times was an instance in which the delay of the arbitration ruling threatens to critically undermine the progress that the city has made on police reform. So they came out against what appeared to be manipulation of the city council by the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the city attorney's office, who both had to agree to that delay.
And when they're talking about it's threatening the process, what they're specifically talking about is Judge Robart looking at that probably with a very skeptical eye, because he still has to approve that contract.
He still has to approve the contract, and he still has to rule that Seattle is sticking to its police reform agreement with the Department of Justice. And he has expressed deep concerns about the contract.
Yes, and specifically the arbitration process that was manipulated in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be fair to say that he's been the one that's pretty much been the stick on getting this whole process to fairly
without a judge to oversee the process, I don't see how any of these reforms would have taken place. But
yeah,
yes.
given that you have a mayor and a city council and a police department that were all skeptical about the need for reform, I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, and Mayor Durkin is the one who came out and said, you know, she believes that this new SPOG contract is the best that the city can do in terms of police reform. That's the same contract that is seeking to institutionalize the closed-door arbitration process.
Yeah, we can't really do constitutional policing. This is the best we can do.
according to our current mayor.
Yes.
All right.
Who was heavily supported by the police lobby in her reaction.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Speaking with policing, developments with a lawsuit that happened in Lakewood?
Yeah, this case hasn't gotten a lot of attention in Seattle media. It's going on in Pierce County down by Tacoma. But in 2015, a Native American man named Daniel Covarrubias was shot and killed by Lakewood police. He had some mental health issues, and he trespassed in a lumber yard and was standing on top of a pile of wood and was holding out a cell phone, and police came in and shot and killed him. The family of Covarrubias sued, claiming that racial bias was involved in his shooting and killing. And the city of Lakewood settled that lawsuit this week for $500,000, which for a suburb of about 50,000 people is a significant hit. It once again underscores that racial bias in policing and problems with excessive use of force is not just an issue with Seattle police, but it's an issue throughout the suburbs in the Puget Sound as well.
Not just a big city issue.
Yeah, and the kind of reforms that we're seeing in Seattle, particularly around police training, are reforms that really need to be enacted by a lot of those smaller police departments and that we have not seen yet. We also haven't seen those kind of reforms in the King County Sheriff's Office, which has had a number of excessive force problems in recent years.
All right. Well, you had mentioned earlier Councilmember Sawant, and she chaired a hearing this week.
Yeah, and as Maria mentioned, she chairs the committee that oversees human services, and had a hearing in that committee this week in Miller Park on the nomination of Jason Johnson to be the new head of the Human Services Department. Johnson had been number two in that department in the past, and there's been all kinds of problems with Johnson in the past, particularly regarding HSD's attitude toward homelessness and homeless services and sweeps and all the rest of that. You had a number of community members coming out to that hearing, notably other members of the committee. Bruce Harrell, Deborah Juarez, and alternate member Teresa Mosqueda did not show up to that hearing, but Sawant was there. You had folks from Shear Wheel and Nicholsville testifying as to Johnson's past predations on homelessness and unwillingness to fairly administer the city's sites for sanctioned encampments. There were other city employees that that testified about alleged sexual harassment and a number focused on the process of Johnson's nomination, and that the office of the mayor Durkin apparently skipped over the city's racial equity and social justice requirements in considering alternatives for that hiring. So the upshot of the hearing is that Sawant is going to go back to the council and ask them to reconsider that nomination and try and get the mayor to come up with a fairer process for considering alternates to that. And the name of Carmen Best, of course, came up quite a bit in that hearing as someone who, again, was skipped over in the hiring process and then magically somehow became a finalist and then 3 days later became the new police chief. So this seems to be a pattern with Durkin where she makes decisions about behind closed doors without much public process about insiders. And the public gets shut out of these important decisions. And in this case, decisions involving our most vulnerable neighbors. And of course, the one night count in Seattle and King County was held last night. So we're going to get, in another 4 months, we're going to get probably another increase in homelessness and more statistics that the crisis keeps getting worse.
So would you say that Durkin is just continuing a trend where Seattle mayors make these decisions on department heads without input from the public?
I think that's been a problem for a number of years, obviously, mm-hmm. but I think Durkin is actually worse about that than Ed Murray or Mike McGann or some of the previous mayors.
Yeah,
she's very much seems hostile to public input, unless you consider public as confined to a fairly narrow slice of the business community.
Yeah, that would be my take on it, is that she doesn't bring in a whole lot of folks from the nonprofit sector to advise her. It's more sort of pro-business lobbyists and consultants that she knows personally.
Yeah, and in this case, with the HSD appointment, of course, there are a number of nonprofits that work directly with service provision for homeless populations and disadvantaged people who are very low income. And they were not consulted mm-hmm. at all. And in fact, they've butted heads with Johnson quite a bit in the past. And he has really abused the bureaucratic process and denied a lot of services that he should have been willing to sign off on.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big issues here is Durkin is sort of avoiding the Seattle process whereby you get buy-in from the different communities that are involved before you appoint somebody as the head of a department. She has not done that. She's basically looked to her own concerns and the concerns of the business community above anybody else.
And you know, people use the term Seattle process negatively to talk about something that just drags out forever. But in this case, you know, Durkin went through most of her first year with acting heads of a lot of departments. She's
been very slow
in making a lot of these appointments.
I don't see the Seattle process as a negative thing. I see it as more of trying to build consensus, which is not a bad thing when you consider all the people who are going to have to work with the head of the Human Services Department. Building consensus on who you have there and somebody who can work across teams, put together teams of people in all sectors is really important. And sometimes taking your time and getting that buy-in is really worth the effort down the road.
That's very true. On the other hand, we've seen past mayors who used the Seattle process
as an
excuse. got a lot of input and then went ahead and did their insider picks anyway.
Yes.
So it can be abused as well. But that collaborative kind of input in theory is the way to go. But we're certainly not seeing it with Durkin.
No.
All right. Also out this week, a poll regarding transportation.
Yeah, and the Seattle Times used this poll as fuel for at least a couple of different articles. It was a poll commissioned by the Seattle Times on transportation solutions. It was conducted by phone, both cell phone and landline, but no data was given on how many of each type of person responded to the poll.
How did they find people with landlines?
As the sample size
was... I have a landline.
You'll see here. The sample size was 680 people total, but some of them were counted twice, approximately 146 people, as both residents of Seattle and residents of King County. I'm not sure if that's kosher or how that's supposed to work. For me, that doesn't work. I'm sorry. For me, that doesn't work. More importantly, I think, is the fact that 75% of the respondents, 75%, are homeowners. Now, in Seattle, the majority of residents are renters, not homeowners, who tend to be older and more conservative than renters.
So, and are much more likely to have landlines.
Yeah, so again, that this poll isn't working for me on that score. I think even more importantly, the Times didn't release the actual questions that they asked or the real numbers of respondents. So we don't know whether the poll was biased in terms of how the questions were phrased or the sample size for their for many of their conclusions, which would tell us how valid those conclusions are. So surprise, surprise, the results skewed towards the concerns of older, more conservative property owners. In particular, they said the most popular, their most popular solution for our traffic problems was more transit or making it easier for non-drivers to get around, maybe because they're hoping that will encourage all those other folks to get out of their cars and get on the bus so that there's more space on the road for them to drive. They were also less enthusiastic about things that homeowners already gripe about, like bike lanes, which steal away parking spaces, and construction of apartment buildings without parking garages, which is, I would have to say, a homeowner's worst nightmare.
Yeah, because it's all that parking just goes on the
street. All that parking goes on the street, and there goes their own parking space. Also, they were very strongly opposed to paying any tolls to drive on downtown streets or freeways to reduce congestion. In fact, they didn't view tolling as a congestion reduction plan at all, but rather as a punitive tax on all drivers. And this is in spite of real-world experience in cities like London and Stockholm, where congestion pricing, or what we here in Seattle are calling tolling, has brought down traffic congestion enormously, lowered noise pollution, lowered air pollution, and it's become very, very popular in both of those cities for that reason.
Of course, it's going to be considered seriously here in Seattle, not specifically because of the levels of traffic, which have actually decreased a little bit in the last couple of years, but because the city of Seattle has set up this enormous problem with downtown traffic by simultaneously doing the convention center construction, the waterfront construction, and the streetcar construction on First Avenue and Stewart Street, all of which will enormously add to the gridlock on downtown surface streets, particularly because the buses that go through the bus tunnel right now, the bus tunnel will be closed soon, and those buses will be on the surface streets as well for several years to come. So downtown surface streets are going to be really problematic, and congestion pricing is almost certain to be considered, and in fact is already being studied by the city as a way to reduce that.
Mm-hmm. That's in addition to our, I think, in the second year in a row, taking the prize for the most cranes, which means construction.
On the city skyline, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And to be clear, you know, comparing that to London or Stockholm, they don't do those kind of, developers can have anything they want approaches to development. Most cities don't. Seattle does.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. King County Council coming out with a proposal.
Yeah, the King County Council said that on Monday, King County Council member Dave Upthegrove will be introducing a bill that would place a moratorium, a six-month moratorium, on building or expanding fossil fuel facilities that would be processing and storage facilities in King County. It does not apply to the city of Seattle. It doesn't apply to facilities that sell petroleum products to the public, like gas stations, for example. It does apply to processing and storage facilities. It doesn't apply to things like pipelines or train trips. Those are train tracks. Those are regulated by the federal government, not by the county. And it is an effort to try to shift the county away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy resources. So that will be introduced on Monday in the King County Council. That was actually proposed by, I believe it is Seattle 350 or 350 Seattle. You can find information on 350 Seattle at their website, 350seattle.org.
And they do a lot of awesome work.
They do a lot of awesome work, yeah, to oppose things like coal shipments and the construction of oil processing and transshipment facilities in Washington, Western Washington.
All right. Also, some obviously with the legislature starting, we've got some bills coming up.
Senate Bill 5376, sponsored by Reuven Carlyle, would allow people to get information from data brokers about what personal information that broker has collected and what they're doing with it. People can then correct any inaccurate data and have old data deleted, but not have all their data deleted. It would also somewhat regulate facial recognition software by requiring prior consent before commercial companies can use it. The penalty for violations would be a fine of $2,500 per violation, which could go up to $7,500 for intentional violations. Now, there are several big weaknesses to that bill.
How is data defined? How broad is this? Does it cover credit companies, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. The weaknesses in the bill include being kind of vague on that determination of data, but it includes not allowing people to have their information removed from a data broker's collection. In addition, you would not be notified in advance before your data is collected, and you would have to find each and every data company and ask each one individually to show you what they've collected, which would be an onerous and burdensome.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. And then how could you prove a violation of the law, since you don't really have any right to privacy under this law, just a right to know that your privacy has been invaded? That's all. So it's a good question of how would you prove a violation?
And what about data collectors that are international?
Yeah. Now, a second bill, House Bill 1503, is sponsored by Republican Norma Smith, is meant to complement Carlyle's bill. But it could be a better first step to data privacy. It would require companies that function as data brokers within Washington state to register with the state, pay a $250 registration fee, and give details on what types of information they collect. So it's the beginning of knowledge, and knowledge really is power. Once you have a list of companies and what types of data they collect, would include international companies working within Washington state, that can be a springboard to stronger laws that require prior consent or laws that limit what data can be collected.
And it wouldn't require you to figure out who data brokers are.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to go around and try to track them all down. Now, Senate Bill, there were four bills that got hearings, that got a big hearing earlier in the week on gun control. House Bill 1074 would raise the legal age for purchase and use of tobacco. Oh, sorry, that's a different one. Purchase and use of tobacco in Washington state to age 21. There's also House Bill 1087.
Tobacco or firearms?
That's tobacco. That's the tobacco bill.
Okay.
House Bill 1087 would establish a long-term care benefit that Washington workers can pay into and use if they don't have long-term care insurance. That's a Democratic-sponsored bill. And then the gun control bills are proposed substitute Senate Bill 5061 to ban undetectable firearms made of plastic, usually on 3D printers. Proposed substitute Senate Bill 5062 bans large capacity magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Senate Bill 5143 would allow law enforcement to seize guns that were used or threatened to be used in domestic violence altercations. And proposed substitute Senate Bill 5174 would require a person to undergo training before they could get a license to carry a handgun. Those are the major gun control bills that were heard this week.
And I would say both the DV bill and the large capacity magazine bill would be huge steps.
Yeah, they would be.
Really very helpful.
Yeah, they would be. And they have a high likelihood of being passed with the Democrats controlling both the House and the Senate this year. And finally, Senate Bill 5001, the recomposting and alkaline hydrolysis of human remains as an alternative to burial and cremation. That was proposed by Senator Jamie Peterson of Seattle. Last year he proposed the alkaline hydrolysis, which is often referred to as non-flame cremation, that is much more environmentally friendly and uses much less energy to produce the same cremation of human remains, as an alternative for people who want a more environmentally friendly way to do cremation. Last year that bill did not pass. This year, he reintroduced it and added recomposting for people who want an even more environmentally friendly way to dispose of their own remains or when they die, or of the human remains of their relatives. It would allow people's bodies to be composted. And you could take it home and add grandma to the garden, or you could opt to have grandpa spread in a conservation area. If you wish.
To be clear, this is after they're dead.
Yes, this is after they're dead. Yes, we laugh, but it's a very important topic.
Yeah,
and
it
there
is.
Are many people who have protested against the. Against standard burial and standard cremation practices being not very environmentally friendly, and that they have expressed the desire to go out in an environmentally friendly way. This bill, if it passes, and it has, I think, a much better chance of passing this year than it did last year. Again, Peterson has worked hard to get buy-in from Republicans as well as Democrats on it. So that could be an option now in the future. I see Mike is laughing pretty hard over there.
It just raises so many questions.
Well, it's not nearly as funny as there is a Republican Senate bill, 5486, which would ban dwarf tossing and any activity that harms the health or welfare of people of small stature who are under 4 feet 10 inches tall.
So it's okay to toss people who are 4'11"?
I guess that bill was introduced by Senator Mike Padden of Spokane Valley. Apparently, dwarf tossing is a thing out in the hinterlands of Spokane Valley.
In the future state of liberty.
Yes. But, you know, I mean, tossing anybody around into a mattress or into a net or whatever is probably not a good idea.
We're going to have to go back to cow tipping. That's.
Hey, Maria can tell you about the truth about cow tipping, having grown up on a dairy
farm
myself.
Yes, cows don't sleep standing up.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
For those of you that were
I'm sorry, cows. Oh. I'm going to repeat that. Cows do not sleep standing up.
All right.
Horses do, but they're a little riskier.
Let's let's move on. Plenty of national news this week.
Yeah, so this is where we stop laughing, right?
Starting with Roger Stone.
Yeah, there were three huge stories, all having to do with the Trump administration yesterday. The first, of course, the pre-dawn raid and arrest of Roger Stone at one of his homes in Florida. Perhaps more interesting than the actual raid is that both in his Florida home and in his home in Harlem, his computers and various other electronic devices and files were also seized. That is likely, as with Michael Cohen's raid last April, to yield a treasure trove of additional evidence about the criminal conspiracies surrounding the Trump Organization. Stone has been a longtime confidant of Donald Trump, and as well as being known as a dirty trickster going back to the era of Richard Nixon. That's really been his niche within the Republican Party. In recent years, he's been known as much more of a purveyor of conspiracy theories and the province of the very far right, and really had been dismissed as kind of irrelevant before the rise of Donald Trump. But he seems to be neck deep in the conspiracy that involved Russian interference in the 2016 election. And the indictment against Stone is well worth reading. I would encourage people to read it. It reads a lot like a Mario Puzo novel, and not just because of the reference to Godfather. And, you know, Stone very clearly now Maria's losing it. Stone very clearly is aware that what he's doing is criminal. The seven indictments, one were for obstruction of justice, one was for witness tampering, including threatening a potential witness that he was going to kill his dog and challenging him to what I think was supposed to be a fight, and five counts of false statements to Congress, that being Stone's testimony last year. The real upshot of this is that within the indictment we see not particularly collusion, but you can see collusion from Roger Stone's porch. We have confirmation that Stone was working directly with WikiLeaks, and that that was probably involving the timing of the release of stolen Democratic National Committee emails and various other things that the Russian hackers got in the spring and summer of 2016.
Apparently working with a member of the Trump campaign in order to time their events and their announcements along with the WikiLeaks release.
Yeah, and his outreach to WikiLeaks was according to the indictment, ordered by a senior member of the Trump campaign. Now, there's really only a couple possibilities for who that senior member could be. One of them would be Steve Bannon, who came in, I believe, late August, early September, as the new campaign manager replacing Paul Manafort.
And there's actual emails between Stone and Bannon.
Yes, and the other would be Trump himself, of course. Mm-hmm. And
perhaps one of his kids, like Donald Jr.
Yeah, Donald Jr. So we're seeing the circle around Trump getting smaller and smaller as these indictments circle around him and get in. To the inner workings of the Trump organization and the Trump campaign. And you really see this mentality of all of these people that of mob bosses, of a mob operation. And of course, the guy at the head of the operation is now president of the United States, which should concern a lot of people. Another thing that should concern an awful lot of people, and this is a story that kind of got buried by the other news yesterday, was an NBC News scoop that Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, was denied top security clearance by career Justice Department people who review such applications, but then overruled along with at least 30 other Trump officials by a Trump appointee. Now, the very top clearance doesn't come from that appointee. It comes from the CIA for sensitive compartmentalized information. This is things like being able to read the daily briefs that Kushner has had access to pretty much every day of Trump's presidency. And the CIA looked at this, and first they went back and saying, how did this guy get security clearance in the first place? There were so many different red flags here. And then they refused to process the SCI application, but Kushner has still been having access to these very, very top secret documents every day of Trump's presidency. And as I said, at least 30 other top officials in the Trump administration would also ordinarily be denied security clearances. And that overruling by the guy's name is Klein, has happened previously maybe once, twice a year ever. It's very, very rare until the Trump administration when the kind of financial entanglements with foreign powers, hostile foreign powers like Russia, seem to be very common among the people that Trump is appointing to these high cabinet-level positions. The other piece of this is that the overruling of the SCI denial by the CIA for Kushner, that could be overruled only by Donald Trump himself, and that apparently is what has happened, although that has not been made public. So you have a large number of people at the head of the Trump administration who have been deemed by career security clearance officials in the Justice Department to be too big of a risk to be granted security clearances. But there they are anyway. And for a president who's been actively investigated for being an asset of a hostile foreign power, that should raise huge concerns about the national security of the United States and underscores the urgency that congressional members are probably feeling for the need to impeach the guy. It's a huge story and one that kind of got buried by the end of the government shutdown and by the Stone arrest yesterday.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the end of the shutdown.
Yes, let's.
Trump basically signed the bill that the Democrats had proposed over a month ago, back before all of this started. It did not include funding for the wall.
He got nothing from this.
Yeah. It will not fund the wall. It will fund the federal government for the next 3 weeks while Congress works on a compromise funding bill for border security, although there could be another shutdown on February 15th if no compromise bill is approved that Donald Trump is willing to sign.
And Trump specifically threatened that in his mm-hmm. statement yesterday and also threatened to declare a national emergency in 3 weeks if he doesn't get what he wants from Congress.
Yeah.
Congress is in no mood to have another government shutdown.
Yeah, now Trump tried to spin this as a win, but it was really clearly a loss for both him and the Republicans.
Capitulation.
Another crisis of his own manufacturing. He gave in for a number of reasons. His popularity was plummeting, and he's very sensitive to those popularity polls. Several Senate Republicans were starting to defect from the party line, with six of them voting for the Democrats' compromise bill on Thursday.
In the Senate.
In the Senate, yeah. And then there were the TSA employees who had started calling in sick.
Yeah, LaGuardia was shut down for an hour yesterday morning, which caused havoc for air traffic around the East Coast. And the threats to the air transportation system were costing, and the sickens by air traffic controllers in particular, were costing airlines a lot of money. And certainly,
with major delays at all of the major airports around the nation.
One of the leaders of the flight attendants had basically said, you know, don't go in. Go and talk to your elected representative and sit in their office until they move on this.
Yeah, and air traffic controllers were issuing a message that it's you can't guarantee the safety of the system.
Right.
So yeah. So
I would say also the Stone's arrest and the NBC scoop, which actually happened Thursday night, were things Trump has a long history of wanting to distract from bad news, and
that
was probably another factor.
One of the interesting things too is I particularly enjoyed a quote that was reported by the Washington Post. Now Trump had been gambling that the Democrats would split between the centrists and the progressive Democrats, much like the Republicans often split between the centrist Republicans and the extreme right wing branch of their party. But he didn't really think that through. You know, I mean, who are the progressive Democrats going to align with? Are they going to align with the Republicans on building a border wall and immigration? No, never.
And he completely underestimated Nancy Pelosi's ability to keep her caucus together, which is something that she's demonstrated a lot in the past.
Oh, yeah. And he was fighting directly with Pelosi and Schumer. They're the leaders of the centrist Democrats. So
he underestimated the woman.
He really, you know, and to assume that either group within the Democratic Party was going to give in and side with the Republicans is just, well, let's call it what it is. It's stupid to think that. You really have to kind of be an idiot. So reportedly, Trump said in a staff meeting, quote, "Why are they always so loyal?" End quote. And that's my quote of the week for you. And my response to that is, you know, unpacking that quote and thinking, you know, how would you respond to that question? The simple answer is they don't owe their allegiance to a liar.
Yeah, and you know he places a premium on loyalty, and he hasn't been getting loyalty.
No, and why would people want to be loyal to someone who lies as a matter of course?
And who will stab
changes
them
on, his mind
and
on
will,
a whim.
And who will stab them in the back or fire them as soon as it becomes expedient,
and force them to take the blame for his own mistakes.
Yeah,
yeah.
All right. Moving on, other developments this week, the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Supreme Court had two decisions, important decisions this week. The first one was to allow the transgender ban in the military to go forward. In June of 2016, President Obama had lifted a ban on transgendered people serving in the U.S. military. During his campaign, Donald Trump claimed that he was very friendly to the LGBTQ community. But don't forget that he did claim that. But a few months after
Vice President Pence, however, did not sign off on that statement.
But a few months after Trump won the presidency in July of 2017, Trump tweeted his intention to ban transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. After about a month, the administration released a formal policy that was set to take effect in March of 2018. But two federal appeals courts, one in California and one in Washington state, blocked the transgender ban from taking effect, recognizing that transgender service members were likely to win their case against the Trump administration in court. Then Trump's team released a revised rule, but it was hit with the same injunctions in court. This week, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision with a conservative wing in the majority, decided to lift the injunctions against the transgender ban, allowing it to take effect while the lawsuit wends its way through the courts. Now, the conservative members of the court, John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, didn't weigh in on the merits of the case itself. They just said that the lower courts are issuing too many nationwide injunctions against Trump's major policy initiatives and that it's time to stop that nonsense. That flies in the face of a different decision that the Supreme Court gave this week. That was to let one injunction stand in particular, the injunction against Trump's plan to shut down the DACA program. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which protects more than 700,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States when they were children. Trump tried to shut down that program in 2017, but the lower courts have repeatedly blocked him with nationwide injunctions. And this week, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal from the Trump administration to lift that nationwide injunction. So apparently, young immigrants, maybe they're less objectionable to the conservatives on the court than transgender people, or maybe it's just the conservatives on the court are wimps and don't want to get into the middle of an immigration reform fight. I don't know what it is, but they're not maybe issuing they're not very rulings with maybe, consistency.
Maybe here. They're not very accurate with their dartboard.
No. So, and you know, you look at the Supreme Court and you look at the two Trump justices on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, and they are certainly starting to have the effect that the Republicans have wanted them to.
And a reminder, a lot of these decisions would be reversed if Merrick Garland were on the Supreme
yes,
Court.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Moving on. International and Venezuela.
Yeah, the ongoing crisis in Venezuela deepened quite a bit this week with major protests in Caracas and other cities in Venezuela. And it's a little difficult to unpack this through the bias of American media that's been covering these protests and through the bias of the United States government, which is trying to interfere in this in a way which really is not at all constructive, particularly the Trump administration taking the unprecedented step earlier this week of recognizing the opposition to President Maduro as the legitimate government of Venezuela, even though they do not have control of the government or of the military, which so far is siding with the Maduro government. The protests are fueled largely over economic issues, the hyperinflation in Venezuela, unemployment, things of that sort. They're somewhat different in character from past leadership crises in Venezuela that have been fueled by protests of the elite, particularly in the reign of Hugo Chavez against the government, the tension between oil companies in particular and the more populist government. Maduro has continued that populist tradition, but has been unable to get a rein on the economy in part because of U.S. sanctions and other international sanctions. And the U.S. Added further fuel to the flames this morning by naming Elliot Abrams as the new envoy to Venezuela. Abrams, for people with very long memories, was neck deep in all the worst aspects of the Ronald Reagan presidency, particularly in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua, where he invariably sided with the fascistic governments there, or the fascistic opposition in the case of the Contras in Nicaragua, and was pardoned by President George H.W. Bush for his role in Iran-Contra, then was resuscitated from the dead once by George W. Bush for a role in his administration, and now is back again with the embalming fluid still dripping from him.
Yes.
But, you know, the appointment of Abrams is going to be seen as a provocation by Venezuela, who considered the attempt to remove Chavez in 2002 as a U.S.-backed coup, which it was, or a coup attempt, I should say, because Chavez survived it. And you know, so far, the U.S. involvement in these protests has not really discredited the protests in the way that you might expect, but this is likely to exacerbate that strengthen the Maduro government, which is the opposite of what the U.S. government wants, and reflects a deep misunderstanding of the role of the U.S. as a purveyor of freedom and opposition optimism, I should say, in Latin America, because they're not. Of course, in addition to the Trump administration, the new fascist government of Brazil also recognized the opposition as a legitimate government of Venezuela, which also underscores that these fascist governments from around the world are working together in international affairs and really casting a fairly malign influence in a lot of issues, not just in Venezuela. And it's not clear what the resolution to this is going to be, or what it can be, given that kind of meddling in international affairs by the United States.
All right, moving on. Ice sheets.
Yeah, last week we talked about the surprise melting of the East Antarctic ice sheet, which is usually considered very stable. This week, a new study looked at the melting of the West Greenland ice sheet. So the attention turned from the South Pole to the North Pole. There's always been the assumption that the West Greenland ice sheet was very stable and, unlike the eastern side of Greenland, wouldn't contribute much to rising sea levels. But a new paper published this week concluded that the low-lying West Greenland ice would become a major contributor to sea level rise sooner than we thought. Ice loss in 2012 was more than 400 billion tons per year in Greenland, four times the rate of melting seen just a decade earlier in 2003. Greenland may have reached a tipping point in which the colder years of the North Atlantic Oscillation are no longer cold enough to stabilize the Greenland ice sheet against the massive warming during the warmer years, which are becoming more frequent. So only 1 degree of planetary warming, which is what we've had so far, may have tipped Greenland past a certain point of no return. Additional global warming could lead to much higher sea levels within just 2 decades if the West Greenland ice sheet continues to melt at its current rate or speeds up.
All right. Also this week, the Davos summit.
The World Economic Forum. Yeah. Donald Trump stayed home because of the government shutdown, a crisis that he manufactured himself. And because he stayed home, other national leaders were able to take the stage and push for their priorities. But their priorities all seem to be dominated by the tech company representatives and other large corporate elites who didn't stay home, who also went to the World Economic Forum in Davos. So the main topic was about imposing regulations on tech companies, many of which are big American corporations like Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, et cetera. It's called data governance. And when the leaders of Germany, Japan, China, and South Africa all called for an international regulatory framework for regulating data brokers and tech companies that handle big data, you could see the hands of tech companies involved there. Their announcement, of course, lacked specifics. Each country has a little bit different emphasis based on their own interest. Germany, for example, is part of the EU, which has passed a strong data privacy rule, so Angela Merkel talked a lot about privacy. China, on the other hand, never talks about privacy concerns because the government owns several major tech companies and they want access to data from all tech companies for surveillance purposes, not too dissimilar from what the United States does under the realm of anti-terrorism work by gathering massive amounts of data and using it to pursue surveillance against the American public. Africa, on the other hand, has almost no rules related to tech companies, but China has built a lot of tech infrastructure there as part of its Belts and Road program, which competes pretty fiercely with investments from Western tech companies. Now, if you look closely, the hand of the tech company lobbyists, you can see are trying to, the tech company lobbyists are really trying to write the rules for these nations, or at least standardize them in a way that would be good for their business. It costs money, after all, for company lawyers to analyze rules that vary from nation to nation. And it's so much cheaper to have one set of international rules, especially if it's pretty vague and not very onerous. So it was Shinzo Abe of Japan who suggested that the World Trade Organization could take the lead in building a framework for data governance by expanding its rules to include data along with goods and services. Of course, that would mean opening up a new round of trade negotiations. And of course, that would bring with it a new round of protests.
All right. Events.
Can we squeeze in the Deutsche Bank item real quickly?
If you can in 30 seconds.
Yeah. People may remember that Deutsche Bank was accused a couple of years ago of money laundering or Russian money laundering to the tune of $15 billion. That was trumped, no pun intended. And of course, Deutsche Bank is a major lender to the Trump organization. They were accused through their Estonia branch of laundering $150 billion, that's B with $1 billion worth of dirty Russian money this week. And that again is something that underscores the seeming Trump organization connections to dirty Russian money and Russian laundering. And
definitely worth checking out that story.
Yes, very much so.
Events.
Today through 5 o'clock, the Duwamish Longhouse is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Go and help celebrate with people whose land this actually is. That is at 4705 West Marginal Way Southwest in Seattle. Also this evening from 5 to 7 o'clock, High Point in West Seattle will be having a tenants' rights boot camp. That will be at the Neighborhood House, 6400 Sylvan Way Southwest in High Point. Tomorrow, Sunday the 27th, from 3 to 6 p.m., the People's Party having their annual General Assembly. That will be at Washington Hall in the CD, 153 14th Avenue. A lot of good speakers at that. And then on Tuesday the 29th, once again, Washington Hall, Socialist into City Hall, building the movement in the 2019 elections. That's hosted by the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, and Socialist Alternative, with speakers Sean Scott and Shama Sawant, both running for council again this year. That'll be also at Washington Hall, 153 14th Avenue in the CD.
All right.